From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, exploring innovation through haiku.
The beauty of this is that those little three-line poems stimulate individuals to think about what innovation means for them and what responsibility means for them. So we're not telling them what to do.
Could the parched West come looking for Great Lakes water?
Just the physical process of moving that water that far is a really difficult endeavor. They looked at this in the 1980s, the Corps of Engineers did.
And keeping an ancient Native American language alive through new poetry.
Many of us are familiar with these words, Michigan, Wisconsin. And so gradually I became much more interested in finding out how to use that language now in these places.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. The parched West has some wondering if California might come looking for Great Lakes water. The answer, not likely. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, busting the water diversion myth. But first.
Collaboration. Innovation.
The next idea.
The world doesn't stop. The world continues to change. So we as people need to change along with it.
This month, we're bringing you the series, Poetically Speaking, Exploring Michigan Poets and Their Work. Well, that poetry extends to innovation. Our latest essay for the next idea explores the concept of responsible innovation through haiku, the traditional Japanese poetry of three lines with five, seven, and five syllables. Andrew Maynard is the director of the University of Michigan Risk Science Center, and he led a project last summer that compiled a book of haiku on responsible innovation. Hello, Andrew.
Hi, great to be here.
You probably are used to people going, what? Haiku, poetry, and innovation? And we've talked on the next idea about the overuse of that word innovation and, you know, some of the negative consequences of always being in pursuit of, an air quotes here, the next big thing. But we haven't looked at that idea of responsible innovation, especially through the lens of haiku. How did this come to be?
So actually, a group of us got together, and a lot of us had this same tiredness with the idea of innovation, or the word innovation, very overused. So partially we were there, a little jaded, trying to sort of think through sort of new ideas, come up with new concepts. But then the haiku thing was really weird as well. So you had a room of people thinking, what the heck just happened? But then we thought about it and we thought, actually, haiku are really great for getting into complex ideas and stimulating people to think about new approaches to, inverted commas, innovation.
Okay. Well, then you've pulled together a book that has haiku. I'm going to throw out one right now in this book, and here it is. Dreaming tomorrow, we see only yesterday, Silicon Valley.
One of my favorites.
What are you getting at with that one, Andrew?
So that was definitely one of my favorites because it captures this idea that almost anywhere in the country you go, apart from Silicon Valley, somebody seems to be trying to recreate Silicon Valley. We're doing it here in Michigan.
A lot.
And the thinking was, we should be doing something different. We should be doing something in Michigan, which is all about Michigan, not about California.
Okay. Right to the point. Now, in your essay for the next idea, you admit that it is quirky, and that's your word, to explore this concept of responsible innovation through this form of traditional Japanese poetry. So I really want to get to that moment when suddenly, boom, out came a piece of poetry. As you guys all got to, not guys, but as this, right, your whole group were together talking, what was that moment like? How did that happen?
So it happens over two or three stages. So first of all, we had an English expert on the panel. We got together a really eclectic group of people. And somewhere over the 2 days that we were discussing a lot of wide-ranging ideas, this guy threw a haiku into the conversation. It was one of those meetings where anything could happen and anything did. And we didn't think much of it, apart from the fact that the two of the drivers behind the meeting were a couple of Dutch designers. So this was an international collaboration. And in the Netherlands are on an innovation kick at the moment. Everything has to be innovation. And these designers and artists thought, what does that mean for us? we innovate all the time, but we don't call it innovation. How on earth are we going to be part of this sort of innovation drive? So smart people that they were, they turned around to the Dutch government and said, give us some money and we'll tell you what innovation is.
Excellent. They got a grant.
They got a grant out of it. And so they came over and they helped us run this very innovative workshop. But at the time, the head of one of the parts of the European Union, who was a Dutch guy, was obsessive about haiku. It was his favorite poetic form. And so they were thinking sort of Dutch guy, European sort of union, sort of European Commission, haiku. There's a connection here. Mm. And the more we thought about it, the more we thought, this is a really crazy but really great idea. And there was one more step to this, which I found fascinating. So we were on about responsible innovation. So how do you innovate in a way where you're going to have outcomes which make money, obviously, but don't harm people and the environment? And we realized that we had some fantastic ideas, but we weren't world-leading experts in this area. There are other people that have written books about this, written really deep academic papers that nobody reads. And we realized if we did the same, if we wrote a paper or a white paper or a technical report after this, it may be great, but nobody would read it. So why not be innovative and write a book of haiku instead? And yeah. The beauty of this is that those little three-line poems stimulate individuals to think about what innovation means for them and what responsibility means for them. So we're not telling them what to do. We're giving them the seeds of creative thought.
What about you? What did you learn about this concept of responsible innovation through this whole process?
So one of the things that really resonated with me was that if you're looking at entrepreneurs, it's got to be built into the culture. You can't tell people how to innovate. You can't tell people how to create things, how to invent things. All you can do is help them think about how to do it better. So that really came through to me. How do you take that individual in a lab or that individual or group of people trying to get a startup going and give them a new way of thinking so that they can create a better, a longer lasting product?
What do you think are the main issues that you address in this book that came out of this fascinating process with all of these eclectic people?
There are a number of issues, but at least some of them are encapsulated in the structure of the book. So the book is actually structured as a haiku. So you start off with pessimism, with us all pulling our hair out, thinking, what is this innovation thing anyway? Is this just a buzzword that is going nowhere? And when people are innovating, are they not really serving society? And then you got to the reflection bit where we thought, well, maybe there is something here. And the optimism bits where we began to look at how you can make sense of innovation, first of all, to solve really big, important problems, but then do that in a very successful way. So you're not only solving social, environmental problems, but you're also making a profit at the same time. So that was sort of one of the challenges and one of the opportunities that we really sort of delved into with this. But there was something else there as well, and this comes back to my academic work. When you come to technology innovation, we're facing a really big challenge because at the edge of technology innovation, we're creating things that we have no idea how to use safely. And the faster we do this, the greater the chances are of something going really wrong. So we've got to work out how to work out what the likely problems are ahead of them happening.
And, you know, it's when I heard that you and I were going to be having this conversation, before I read your essay, I thought of the line in Jurassic Park that you actually put into your essay, which was Jeff Goldblum's character, Dr. Ian Malcolm, who we warned your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could that they didn't stop to think they should.
Should, yes.
That was that. I remember that from seeing that thing back in 1990, and it hit, and that really, really says a lot.
And it really resonates with me.
Yeah.
And if you look back over the last 200 years, actually, we've had missteps with innovation, but we've dodged the bullet on many occasions. There are only so many times you can dodge that bullet before something really bad happens.
What is your favorite haiku in the book?
Some of my favorites are the ones that begin to look at how you make a connection between what people can do and what society gets really excited about. So there are a couple that really sort of focus on that. I'll read just one out, which is about the idea of telling stories. So this is, compelling stories reveal opportunities hidden by data. And I love the idea because if you're a tech geek, data is sort of your bread and butter.
Yes.
But it doesn't mean that much to other people, whether they're investors, whether they're consumers, customers, local communities.
You can see people's eyes glaze over.
That's right. But if you can tell stories about the data, things get really interesting. So another one, and again, this gets to the heart of what I do so much of the time with my academic work, which is also looking at thinking differently about risk. So this is choosing among risks. We need imagination of lives yet unlived.
Very good.
And I love the idea of thinking about future generations and thinking how innovation now is going to serve them.
And drilling into the idea of the next idea and looking at Michigan, why should we in Michigan be concerned with understanding what this idea of responsible innovation is?
The biggest challenge, I think, is in any area of innovation now, it's harder to get something to market and ensure that that's going to be successful without thinking of a much wider range of drivers than are you just technologically successful. And so you've got the society around you, you've got regulation around you, you've got unanticipated consequences of creating something which is going to harm the environment. The smart innovators are the ones that at least think through these consequences up front. So if they've got a range of ways in which they can innovate, in which they can actually develop a new product, they can choose the one which is more likely to be acceptable to people, more likely to solve real problems within society, more likely to resonate with people enough so that they actually make a profit out of it, but it actually solves somebody's problem.
And as you say, looking ahead to the lives unlived.
That's exactly it. And of course, it's a global challenge. But if you look at what we're doing with innovation at the moment in Michigan, it's very relevant to making sure that Michigan both stays on the map and gets bigger on the innovation map.
Andrew Maynard's essay is on the Next Idea page. Just go to michiganradio.org. And we have put up more of the haiku from that project that he pulled together, Exploring Responsible Innovation Through Haiku. And we invite you, feel free to share your own haiku. Who knows what could come from this innovation?
Mm-hmm.
Andrew is the director of the University of Michigan Risk Science Center. Pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Vintners in Michigan could have another disaster on their hands this year. Last year, Michigan vineyards produced about one-fourth of the grapes grown in a normal season. And the results could be about the same this year. And that might leave wineries with little in their cellars. Interlochen Public Radio's Peter Payette reports.
Mark Johnson knew something like this could happen. He's been growing grapes on Old Mission Peninsula since the early 1980s. He says back then, faculty at Michigan State University thought it was a bad idea. That's because popular European grape varieties can't handle temperatures too far below zero. Johnson figures people like him were a little naive.
We've got a gut feeling. We look around us and we think this is about as close to heaven as we're gonna get, and there should be a vineyard in heaven, so we're planting.
The view of Grand Traverse Bay from Chateau Chantel is heavenly. But these days, Johnson is recalling those warnings from MSU as he surveys frost-bitten vines.
So, let's cut another one.
To do this, he cuts buds open with a knife to see if they're dead.
Of course, everyone I cut, I know is dead. So we don't like to cut too many. And here, as well, you can see it's brown or black there in the middle all the way through. So both of those were dead.
Chateau Chantel produced just 75 tons of grapes last year. This vineyard can produce 300 tons in a good year. 2013 was a bumper crop, and so Mark Johnson says they have plenty of wine to get through this summer. But if this year's crop is like last year's, he says wineries in Michigan will be importing grape juice from Washington to make wine for 2016.
Because if we don't have it ourselves, we can't just close the doors. And so all of the wineries are going to have to be looking to supplement whatever they have with juice from somewhere else.
Nobody knows whether this year will be as bad as last year, but the signs are not good. Duke Elsner is with MSU Extension and says in addition to frozen buds, it appears the vines themselves were damaged more this winter.
And it is possible for some recovery of the woody tissues. So it will really be a roll of the dice for a while, waiting to see how well they recover, how good a spring they have probably will help decide that.
So vintners like Brian Albrecht at Leftfoot Charlie are planning for the worst, even though he does see a silver lining. Albrecht figures it's a chance to draw attention to how precious the grape crop is in northern Michigan.
None of this can we really take for granted. I can't just order more grapes and build another widget here. You know, we get one harvest, you get one chance to make the wine. And so we're going to kind of use this as a way to teach the public, to continue to teach the public about how special our wines really are. And part of that specialness is there's going to be some years where they're not as widely available.
If Albrecht does have to order grapes to keep his tasting room in Traverse City going, he says he'll make it clear those wines are not Michigan wines, like he did with cider in 2012 when the apple crop in Michigan was frosted out.
And so we had a cider that year called Empty Bushel. That was our, and we said, look, this is from New Hampshire. This is a story of how this community of agriculture does work together to help each other out in tough times.
And he's also looking hard in the back of his wine cellar, where he has stacks of bottled wine he's piled up over the years.
So pretty much everything over here is library wine.
Albrecht says winemakers have a kind of rainy day fund because they're always setting aside cases of wine and trying to forget about them.
There's years I've looked at this and said, whoa, you're squirreling away way too much. What are you doing? And then this comes around and I look at it and I say, wow, you have a great opportunity to start showing these things.
So Albrecht plans to release some of these older vintages to keep his supply up. Some are wines that might have never been offered to the public.
A lot of those wines I save for wine writers and people from out of the area that are trying to understand the breadth of our industry and not just the current snapshot. So we save older wines to show how they age, how they develop over time. And now this will give us a chance to do that on a little bigger scale with everybody.
When asked what happens if cold weather freezes grape buds a third year in a row, Brian Albrecht says he can't look that far ahead. And then he adds he's a Cubs fan, so he's one of the most hopeful people you'll ever meet. For Stateside, I'm Peter Payette.
Continuing now with our special series, Poetically Speaking. Margaret Newton has made it her life's work to fight for the future of an ancient language, Anishinaabemowin. This is the language of the group who calls itself the People of the Three Fires, the Odawa, Potawatomi, and Ojibwe. These people came to the Great Lakes thousands of years ago. Today, this ancient language is threatened. They're losing speakers faster than they're gaining them. Margaret Newton's new book of poetry is one way she's trying to keep this language alive and fresh. Weweni is a collection of poems in Anishinaabemowin and in English. Margaret Newton is an assistant professor of English and American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she's here with us now from Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. So good to have you with us on the program, Margaret.
Anine, it's great to be here.
Would you tell us more about the language of the people of the Three Fires and the people themselves?
Well, the easiest thing to say is just take the Great Lakes and put a circle around it that goes about 500 miles all the way around the Great Lakes, which will take you through parts of Ontario, a little bit of Manitoba, North Dakota, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, and there are people in all those areas that use the language.
How did you come to be a speaker? Did you grow up with it at home?
I grew up hearing it a lot, but most people my age did not grow up in a household where it was the first language. For most people now, it's something that you have to really make a choice to learn later. And I started hearing it, I would say, in my teens, my 20s, and became really curious about how can we understand this place and this sound of this place. I mean, many of us are familiar with these words, Michigan, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, all these city names, place names that we're very familiar with. And so gradually I became much more interested in finding out how to use that language now in these places.
And you certainly do that in this collection of poems, Weweni. And is it something that you really can see a progression of Anishinaabemowin where it is kind of fluid and changing as the years go by and you put them into these poems?
I would say I see it both ways. So on one hand, what we have really tried to do in the past couple of decades is something you would call language preservation, which is to really make sure that those old stories, some of the old songs, those things that are the most familiar refrains of this area are preserved and that we can replicate those and that the next generation can continue to sing those songs and tell those stories. On the other hand, it really does need to be viewed as a modern language. Not many of us speak exactly as our grandparents did, and it's usually the mark of a young generation to purposefully speak differently than their elders. So it's a mix between trying to really respect and imitate as closely and clearly as we can the tradition before us, but then also carry it forward as a modern, vibrant language and allow it to change.
Margaret, what does the title of this collection of poems mean?
Weweni is a word that was probably one of the earlier words I learned. People used it almost like saying goodbye. There are a lot of idiomatic phrases that people will use instead of goodbye. There is no bye that you have to signal not seeing a person again. And so what you say is something like weweni, or is take care, or be careful on your journey. Or you might say gigawabamin, which is I will see you again. Some people say bamampi, which is maybe a reference to see you again in this place or something. So it's one of our phrases that we use when we take leave, but in this kind of gentle way, knowing we'll see someone again.
Why did you choose that word for this collection?
I chose that one because it has in it the essence of sound. So we would also use the word anawewin for how we speak and the way we sound. And so to me, it was this nice blend of having a meaning that was so familiar and common, but also at the heart of it, a little bit of a note about the language itself and about sound itself. I also now spend a lot of time in the Wisconsin area where the Menominee people, our neighbors, and their creation story places them right in Wisconsin. And for them, they use the word wewene for thank you. So it was something that kind of crossed languages and crossed communities.
Well, let's get an idea of the poetry in weweni. If you would you be so kind as to read the poem called The Promisers to us? But first, set it up for us. Can you tell us what the inspiration was and what it's about?
In that case, I think one of the reasons many, many people learn the language is so that they can hear what elders are saying. And sometimes what elders are saying are highly important ceremonial things, and you really know you need to pay attention. But then sometimes they're just telling jokes, or they're laughing, or the little old ladies are talking about the little old men. And so I think sometimes we realize that our words can mean so much, and they can be taken lightly. They can be taken seriously. And I think we realize that we play with our words. We twist them sometimes, and that was what kind of inspired that poem. The Promisers. Sometimes the rain came twice, and that is when they lied. The old men twisted dusty promises they once made as young lovers. The old ladies baked the tales until they rose beyond believability. The grandchildren adored them for this ability to reimagine their lives, and their own children were frightened by the idea of what they themselves would say one day. Wawindamojik. Nanagodnong nijing gemewan, miwi api gi giwanamuat. Aki enziak biminawak, bingwi wawindamadawinan. Gi wawindamadiwat enjizagading. Mindmoyensak gebozanawan, debajamoanan binish umbishka awasa debwetaguk. No shensak ozagiawan, zamgash gitoat anishayendamoat ejimadazewat. Oni janisak gizagazewak, zamgikendamoat ngoding wa ejidebajamoat.
I'm speaking with Margaret Newton, who has written a book called Weweni, Poems in Anishinaabemowin and English. I'm wondering, can you give us a sense, Margaret, what is it about Native American poetry that truly sets it apart, the special thing that you probably don't find in poetry from other traditions and cultures?
It would be two things, I think. For one, you have a strong sense of place. And I think any poetry does that. If you listen to Irish poets or you listen to poets of any place, any culture, any community, they're really trying to echo that space, that sense of identity that goes beyond the individual sometimes. And I think in each language, you're going to have such unique ways of doing that. So, for instance, in the Anishinaabemowin, you can hear just even in the name of the language, there are so many rich melodic vowel patterns, and to really be able to play with that is a part of what is enjoyable, I think.
I'm wondering, in the culture of the people of the Three Fires, what does it mean to be a poet?
I don't think it means a thing, which is kind of fun and actually kind of freeing. I hope in the future it does start to mean something more. But we really have storytellers, and sometimes those stories take the shape of a play. Sometimes they take the shape of a song. Sometimes they take the shape of a poem. The notion of genre, the way I might teach it in a classroom at a university, is not something that is traditional to Anishinaabe. They have the Atizokanuk, which are the more sacred, serious stories, so stories that go really beyond the present time that we're in. And you have the Debajimonuk, and those are the stories that are kind of the news or maybe the comedy, the regular stories of everyday life. And so it's a different division. You have two types of stories, and they can take any shape. The genres we use when we talk about language and literature in English are very different.
I'd love if you would read us a final poem, and it was one that I kind of wish we could just broadcast to every corner of the world. It's called The Way We Meet. Can you tell us a little about what led you to write this poem before you share it with us?
This one has a really rich Michigan, in particular, Ann Arbor history. One of my very good friends, Ari Weinswig, has written a series of books called The Lapsed Anarchist Guide to Leadership. And it was a project that he really spent his lifetime working on. And then he spent many hours in the Labadie collection at the University of Michigan Library. And I would often go there with him and run into these things. And I would think, yeah, a lot of this politics, a lot of this sense of people being free to think in the way that they want to think is at the core of so much about diversity. So whether I'm talking about why my language should survive, or whether he's talking about ways to lead involving individuals and their ability to have free thought, it really crossed over. So I started out with an Emma Goldman quote, which just the task of having to translate that into Anishinaabe one was fun, and then tried to write about the ways that people do meet and how you can maintain your own sense of freedom but come together on certain things as well.
Will you share that with us, please?
Sure. The way we meet. Long ago, in the mixing, we were shaken in every direction, different children of the sky and the land. To survive now, we must be at peace in our hearts, understand one another, and bravely remember we are all, one by one, cousins. Let's meet one another here, now, on earth, before we become heavenly ancestors, wearing a necklace of stars visible to our heirs. Nakwesh gada dida, me wenja, de gonagad magot. Gigosh kawaj bijanong, on dad is a young gijagong, minua a king. Nongum jab we young, gosh kawad is a young, nisidota is a young, mash komikwendamong, gak in a wea, in a wendy young. Nakwesh kada dida, nongum a king oma, jibwa jibayak ayaying, bizakimong. Nabekwagen anong, wabmangwa gini Johnson enoch.
The book is Weweni, Poems in Anishinaabemowin and English. Margaret Newton is an assistant professor of English and American Indian Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, and she joins us from Wisconsin Public Radio in Milwaukee. It was a pleasure to meet you and to share your love of the language. Thank you so much, Margaret.
Miigwech, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs and the National Endowment for the Arts. And we'd love to hear from you. What stories do you want to hear and people you want to know more about? Just let us know. Find us on Facebook. Search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And as always, MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. California's drought is in its fourth year, And since California produces nearly half of America's fruits, vegetables, and nuts, this drought could be felt in grocery store aisles across the country. Governor Jerry Brown has imposed California's first-ever mandatory water restrictions, hoping to cut water usage in cities and towns by 25%. Some in Michigan and other Great Lakes states are wondering, could the parched West be eyeing Great Lakes water? Mark Brush is Michigan Radio's online reporter and editor with the Environment Report. Good to have you here, Mark.
Nice to be here, Cindy.
True or false? One of the best ways to keep California green and crops and cattle hydrated would be to divert water from the Great Lakes and get it to California?
Pretty much false. I mean, you never want to say never in this business, but this is pretty close to never as possible. And setting politics aside for a second, just the physical process of moving that water that far is a really difficult endeavor. They looked at this in the 1980s, the Corps of Engineers did. And they weren't looking at moving the water all the way to California. They were looking at moving it to irrigate parts of the Oglala Aquifer. So they were going to move Lake Superior water, this is the proposed plan, to Yankton, South Dakota, in the upper parts of the Missouri River, a distance of 500 miles. And they discovered
just 500 miles?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's not that far.
No.
And when we're talking about California, we're talking 2,000 miles. So keep that in mind.
Yeah.
And they found that to move the Lake Superior water that far, there's elevation change to lift that water. If you think about water, a gallon weighs 8 pounds. So if you think about walking upstairs with a bucket of water.
Yes.
It takes a lot of energy.
Okay.
So it was going to take 7 1,000 megawatt power plants just to lift the water that far to Yankton, South Dakota. The cost in 1980s dollars was going to be $26 billion. So quite a bit of cost, and that's just building it. That doesn't include pumping it that far.
So I think that answers that question that we hear people talk about. Could we see a pipeline running from the Great Lakes to the far west?
Yeah, it's funny. And when I talk to the people in the Southwest in California, they say, that's a great idea. We would love your water. But they kind of laugh at the idea as well.
All right. So they may cast covetous eyes, but just the sheer logistics and cost of that. And then talking politics, we know that the 8 Great Lakes states formed the Great Lakes Water Resources Compact in 2008. How does having that compact help protect the Great Lakes from diversions as we continue to feel the effects of a warming globe?
The politics is pretty ironclad, too, now, because in 1998, we had a scare. Back then, we had the Nova Group, this Canadian company who wanted to ship Great Lakes water, you know, bring tankers into Lake Superior, fill their supertankers with water, and bring it to Asia and sell it there. This was a proposal in Canada they were going to do, and that stirred a lot of emotion here in the region. It put into place this political process where they developed the Great Lakes Water Compact. And that's a pretty ironclad agreement.
And it's between or among?
It's among all 8 Great Lakes states. So any one of the 8 Great Lakes states' governors can veto it. That governs the U.S. side of the agreement. And the Canadians have a similar agreement on their side. Doesn't allow diversions to any communities outside of our basin. Now, it does allow diversions for straddling counties. If there's a county that exists on the Great Lakes watershed basin, and that watershed goes right through the middle of the county, the community on the other side can request that water.
Okay.
And that's what's happening in Waukesha. But in order for them to get that water, all 8 Great Lakes governors have to sign off on it. Pretty high bar to get through.
Right. In fact, I remember we talked about that on stateside. Just to refresh everyone's memory, Waukesha in Wisconsin wants to tap into Lake Michigan for drinking water because its aquifer has dropped so much that basically it's left with unhealthy levels of radium and salt. And I remember its water manager said that 10.1 million gallons a day was, in his words, the equivalent, quote, of a teaspoon out of an Olympic-sized pool. But one has to ask, does saying yes to Waukesha open a dangerous door?
One thing that we should keep in mind is that Waukesha has to return all that water. They cannot even propose taking Great Lakes water without returning that water. In their proposal is this process of where they draw water out, they treat it to Clean Water Act standards, and they return it to the basin. So there's a little bit lost, but it doesn't get diverted out of the basin. That's part of the Great Lakes Compact.
Now let's circle back to California as we wrap up. What's the best option? I mean, I'm thinking of driving along the Pacific Coast Highway, and there's a lot of water right there. It's salt water, but
for them, I mean, it's a really expensive process. Desalinization of that salt water is an option. Super expensive, but it's still an option. It would be less expensive than transporting Great Lakes water across the Rockies or something like that. You know, another big thing, if you think of water, in some ways it's a lot like electricity. We can save a lot just through conservation. That's what the state is now going through now, is taking a hard look at how they use water, and a lot can be saved in that way as well.
Mark Brush is Michigan Radio's online reporter and editor with the Environment Report. Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks, Cindy.
Governor Snyder takes his Making Government Accountable tour on the road today. He says his mission is to tell Michigan's comeback story. First, Las Vegas for meetings with the Republican Jewish Coalition. Then to Washington for the White House Correspondents' Dinner this weekend. Then on to Santa Monica, where he'll talk about Detroit's bankruptcy journey. Some wonder if, along with touting Michigan, Snyder is doing a little touting of himself with an eye on what might come next for a term-limited governor. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us. Daniel, I like the way you phrased it in your column this week, that this kind of sort of looks like a presidential flirtation. How much juice do you think is in this?
Well, I think more than he certainly is willing to acknowledge. I've had the opportunity to speak with some big supporters of his, and they tell me that he has been out trying to raise money for this Making Government Accountable group. But it's really a bit of a stalking horse to test the waters for a potential presidential run. And they are basically telling him, what are you doing? The Republican field is well-stocked, as we all know. A lot of the people who are already in it have got a much higher visibility than the governor does, and frankly, probably would be more appealing to the base of the party. And all this is going on while we've got the road tax coming up for a vote in about 2 weeks.
I might point out, carpe diem. I mean, there's so much buzz right now over the Detroit bankruptcy exit and you know, Michigan's recovery. Why shouldn't he get some national face time for whatever that next chapter might be?
Well, that's a fair point. I'm not saying he shouldn't. Yeah. Don't misunderstand me. And I take your point about the buzz about Detroit. I don't think there's any question about it. And frankly, I think that's going to continue. You know, there had been some of his supporters that said to me privately, expressed some concerns that maybe that exact thing would happen, that they would try to milk the Detroit situation for more national publicity. And I think that's kind of what we're seeing happen here, because you can't go to Nevada, you can't, you know, go to Washington, you can't go to California and sit on a panel and not talk about what happened in Detroit. The Detroit bankruptcy and also the success of the auto industry coming out of the bailout
right.
are cornerstones of the Snyder years. I don't think there's any question about that. I mean, the other things that are more esoteric and more basic government, you know, budgeting and tax reform, that doesn't really push through in the national debate, but certainly taking Detroit bankrupt and getting it out in 16 months, that's pretty impressive.
What about not the top of the ticket? What do you think he might bring as a vice presidential candidate or possibly running for Debbie Stabenow's seat in the Michigan Senate?
I don't see either one of those as likely as much as something, a potential cabinet post.
Mm.
Could you see a Rick Snyder as the budget director, the federal budget director? I mean, here's a guy who understands the numbers, you know, has a very good vision of how a lot of things fit together. I could see something like that before I could see him running for Senate. And as far as vice president, ask yourself this. We've been listening to him for 5 years talk, explain his positions. How effective do you think he would be on a national campaign trail?
Interesting.
I mean, does he have the style? I mean, because style matters. And when you're a vice presidential candidate and you're going, you're speaking to people all over the country, you know, how you deliver those words and how you deliver the message is important. I think the governor's position, and I think it's admirable in a lot of ways, is to say, look, it's not so much how I say things, it's what do I do? And that's a very fair point. Problem is that doesn't necessarily work when you're a first-timer on a national ticket. It has a lot to do with how do you say things and what is your style and how does it come across. But here I would say one other thing. If this vote on May 5th on the road package goes down, some people I've talked to have said any talk about a presidential run dies with it.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Always good to talk with you, Daniel. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Let's hear some new indie rock and soul tunes that dig into issues of race, inequality, and religion. They come from the west side of the state. Michigan Radio's Emily Vox has this profile on the first album being released by Grand Rapids, Vox Vidora.
Downtown Southside bus stop, need a ride. 'Cause we lived on the other side. The black was
as hot as a sauna. We would go fish among the piranhas. And I wonder, where is our home?
I'm joined by vocalist Molly Bousma Schultz and her husband and bass player Scott Schultz of Box Fedora. And we're listening to a song called Downtown Southside off their debut album, which will be released on Saturday. Molly, you write the lyrics for Box Fedora. Tell me what this song's about.
Downtown Southside really came to me when I was thinking back to my life living in West Michigan as a kid with my mother. I lived all over town. We always jumped from one apartment to another. I'm just kind of describing what it's like to get through the city either on foot or via bus, and what some of my relationships with neighbors could be like, sometimes contentious, sometimes fun.
And so you grew up on the southeast side of Grand Rapids?
Yes, that's right.
And what was life like growing up for you?
Well, my mother was a single mother, and I did not grow up with a father. So it was mostly just her and I kind of living life together. I was homeschooled.
And your mother is white and you are biracial. Tell me more about what that was like for you growing up on the southeast side of Grand Rapids.
Well, I think some of our neighbors couldn't really figure us out because at that time during the late 80s, early 90s, it wasn't as typical to see a biracial kid with a white mother. And we got a hard time from a lot of people. A lot of questioning, you know, about identity.
And they didn't know that they were just like me. They only saw what they wanted to see. Oh, yeah.
And do you think that race is an issue in the city now?
Definitely. I think it'd be too flowery to say it's not an issue. I think it's different, and I think a lot of people in the community are very engaged with addressing that and trying to build better relationships and to create inclusion. But, race is always a contentious issue, I think, especially where I'm from.
And Scott, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, I guess Grand Rapids is kind of got a bad distinction of being one of the more segregated places in Michigan and the U.S. What we love about Grand Rapids is the neighborhoods. It's like a little Chicago in a lot of ways, but it also means, you know, our southwest side is very Latino, our southeast side is very African-American. I think we're part of a generation that really wants to start breaking those barriers down because we're living all over town. We're meeting people from different parts of the city, whereas before, you know, it was people growing up in the suburbs or, you know, just distinct communities. So we're late to the game in Grand Rapids, but I think we're finally becoming a melting pot, and it's getting better, but I do know what Molly's talking about, the 80s and 90s in Grand Rapids. Growing up on the southeast side would not have been very nice. Lots of crime, lots of poverty, and it wouldn't have been easy to get around. And especially when you stick out, it doesn't make life easier.
And Scott, you grew up on the north side of Grand Rapids. Describe how your experience growing up may have differed from Molly's.
Yeah, we could have been a million miles away. You know, we were only 10 miles away, but, you know, very suburban, white middle class upbringing.
So let's talk about the song Let Me Be.
You think I'm just colored and complacent. You put me in a box because you don't want to face it. Simplify, but if you saw the way my lips quivered when I sit slouched because I can't identify. Identify my purpose or my own thoughts, so maybe you just let me be.
So Molly, that clip from the song Let Me Be starts off with, you think I'm just colored and complacent, put me in a box because you don't want to face it. What are you talking about here?
I'm kind of talking about dual things here. One being as a female artist and woman of color, I've experienced a lot of sort of questioning of what my intentions are, of what my plans are. Like, how are you going to do this? How are you going to make it? What are you really going after? And I guess it's driven me to work harder, but, you know, that's not always a great feeling.
So obviously, I'm getting at the fact that people have treated me like I don't work hard enough, but I know that I do. And then also, on a darker side of that, I'm really talking about Trayvon Martin and lots of African-American men who have been murdered. And so, yeah, this idea that black men are just here to be taken out, yeah, it's tough to talk about.
Let me be, let me be, let me be, let me be, let me be.
And let's talk about the song, I Saw Love.
I'm not afraid of your biblical rules. And I'm not afraid of your hypocritical fools. I'm not afraid of your universal love. I ain't seen nothing but I tell you what I saw love.
So the west side of the state is generally known as Michigan's Bible Belt. How much of that influenced this song?
Quite a bit of it. That line is really talking about the way that individuals, be it leaders of churches or whatever that might be, the way that they've used the Bible to justify forms of oppression. We've seen it in our historical past as a nation, whether it be from slavery to immigration to gay marriage. You know, 40 years ago, Scott and I wouldn't have been able to get married because I'm black and he's white. And I don't think that's okay. So it's not that I don't believe that the Bible is a wonderful, beautiful book. It's just that when people cherry pick and use that to oppress others, I just don't agree with that.
I've been speaking with Molly Belsma-Schultz and Scott Schultz of Vox Fedora. Their debut album, Promised Land, will be released on Saturday. A CD release show will happen that night at Founders Brewing Company in Grand Rapids. They came into Michigan Radio Studios and gave us an amazing high-energy performance of two songs off the album as part of Michigan Radio's Songs from Studio East. You can check it out at michiganradio.org. Today's Stateside was directed by Ellie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Bob Scon. Contributors are Mercedes Mejia, Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Joe Lindstroth, and Annie Norris. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.